ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Have you ever sat under a flickering overhead light and thought, this feels like a form of torture? Or worked in an office with no access to natural light at all? Now, imagine those everyday irritations and distractions multiplied and intensified. And you start to understand how the built environment can profoundly affect people who are neurodivergent.
Managing the environment is just really stressful. So people are having to work hard to work out what that noise is, to cope with that, and then to focus on doing what they're meant to be doing. And often, it's actually really overwhelming. So it's got to that state where people are saying, I can't be here anymore.
Going out into public is something we do a lot of research on in our household. We do a lot of research on what's the likely quietest time, what would be the main sources of noise, how long are we planning on spending there, that kind of thing.
Autism is a spectrum. So you have got people with all these different needs and wants as well. And then you've got architecture that has many different ways to meet the same brief. So you've got two moving parts. So this is where the creativity and thinking outside the box is really, really important.
I'm Anthony Burke, and this is By Design on ABC Radio National. On the show today, how the built environment can quite literally shape the way you move through the world. Then, later, on Extraordinary Everyday, we dive into a staple of men's business fashion, the tie. It's everywhere, but how did this simple strip of fabric end up with such a firm hold on men's necks and style? The built environment can seem pretty unremarkable, almost invisible, when it's designed with you in mind. But the moment you move through it with disabilities, you start to notice how quickly ordinary can turn into frustrating or just plain exhausting. We've made progress in understanding how to create spaces that are more accessible for people with physical disabilities, even though there's still plenty of work ahead. But what about people who are, say, autistic? Dr. Tom Tutton is head of Aspect Autism Friendly. He advises and helps to shape public spaces for those on the autism spectrum.
It's really clear when you spend time with autistic people how much the environment impacts them. Imagine yourself sitting in a cafe, and in that cafe, there are stripped walls. You've got a concrete floor, you've got tables and you've got chairs, you've got people chatting away, you've got mugs and china clinking away, people talking. On top of that, you've got an open kitchen. So you've got all of the noises and smells of the kitchen bursting out, coffee grinders, the soup being made. On top of that, you've got speakers which pump music into that space as well. If you can feel all of that when you're in there, even if you're not autistic, I think it's really overwhelming for many of us. But for neurodivergent people, it becomes almost inaccessible and almost hard for people just to simply go and have a quiet cup of coffee.
So you've mentioned a whole range of different potential stimuli there. And I'm wondering then, how do we kind of flip that script and talk about, well, tell me, what are some of the good elements of design that we should be seeing more of than in our spaces?
The sensory stuff, I guess, is the most obvious place. So thinking about lighting, rather than having one big bright cold bulb overhead shining down, do all of the opposites. Perhaps have light hidden away. It can be behind somewhere, so it's more refracted or radiant. You can use high quality LED bulbs that don't flicker. You can use warmer colors rather than colder colors. You can cover your lights so that the light, you don't see the bulb itself and the light is more diffused as well.
Yeah.
You can use lamps and things like that. Sound is something, again, which I think is really important. We can have environments that is the opposite of that cafe. So places that soak up the sound, you can have materials, sound panels, baffles, curtains, other warm materials that help the sound to dissipate and disappear off. Particularly the other things, I guess, are things like the tactile sense. So using a range of materials. So sometimes certain materials can feel very uncomfortable to some people. So allowing people to choose materials to sit on that are comfortable for them and not only having one material. But even something like if you're in a public space and you are queuing or waiting, if that's disorganized, there's a risk that somebody might bump you or nudge you And that can be perceived as painful by many autistic and neurodivergent people. So having a really clear sense of how the world is organized. You stand here, other people stand away. With COVID, one of the things, obviously it was a dreadful time for all of us, but one of the things we love to see was all of the additional instruction people put into the environment. Enter here, exit here, stand on this dot, you stand further away. And it just meant that all of a sudden these environments were wonderful. People knew how to queue and where to stand and what to do. And we were like, oh no, they've taken it all away. But all of those things that make a really, really big difference.
So a big part of this is trying to take the uncertainty out.
Every moment of uncertainty is another drop in that bucket of stress that people are already carrying a lot of stress.
Danielle's a mum of two kids on the spectrum, and she's managing her own ADHD and dyslexia too. The unknown can be tough, so they rarely leave home without checking what they're walking into. One thing that's really helped is the sensory map. It gives her a clearer picture before they even get there.
One of the things I have found really useful, we've started to go to the National Gallery of Victoria, have like low sensory sort of sessions where there are very few people, usually on a weekend or like a random afternoon, but we go to the weekend ones primarily. And as part of that, they have sensory maps of their exhibitions. So you know where the light's going to be, where the music's going to be. So that when your child might have a really big emotion, which some people may also refer to as a meltdown, then you know where the quiet space to retreat to is, away from the eyes of people who may not understand what they're looking at.
And is a sensory map something on your phone, something on a piece of paper that you hold in your hand? It's literally a map of the gallery, yeah?
Literally a map of the gallery that says, this is where the music is, this is where it's going to be bright lights, that kind of thing.
And are these common, sensory maps?
I have seen them more and more in public places like that, which does make it a lot easier when you're me. I know that, for example, some supermarkets offer a autism-friendly or low sensory hour, but it's at like 10 a.m. on a Tuesday or Thursday, which isn't super convenient for people who work, but people are trying to, I guess, make these sorts of issues a little bit more open. So that way, if you're like me and you're looking for this information, it's easier to find.
So we can rethink public spaces to make them feel less chaotic and more welcoming by adjusting the kinds of materials we use and providing greater predictability for neurodivergent people. But what about our homes? Because when you've got a bunch of people with different tastes, needs, and communication styles all sharing one space, creating a true sanctuary gets tricky fast. Shelley Deville has been exploring this challenge. She's a building advisor and founder of Enabling Spaces. And in 2019, she completed a Churchill Fellowship looking at how countries around the world design for neurodiversity. She helps people to build homes that suit their individual neurodivergent needs.
Family homes are in some ways simpler than a commercial or public space. In other ways, they can also be complex. So if you've got more than one person in the family with autism or neurodiversity, then you need to look at everyone's needs. So it really starts from the front gate, and we look at the whole environment, the land, the design of the home. But there's three things that I look at, and I call them the design trio. And then it's designing for the senses, which is the one that most people think of first. Then we're designing for the mind. So how do we design for cognitive and executive function? And then designing for the human, remembering that everyone that we're designing for has their own likes, dislikes. We're designing for us personally as well.
So run us through maybe then some of those general principles that homes should include. So you kind of get a sense of a foundation to start from.
The two most common sensory issues are light and sound. What can we do to minimise that or control that? You know, what are the triggers? So we look at that and how do we adjust the sounds? Now that could be about the family member with autism having their own space that is treated accordingly. So they've got an escape space to go into. It could be adding more acoustic insulation or acoustic methods into different parts of the home so that some rooms are not so loud. And then we look at lighting. Now, indirect natural lighting is probably the optimum, what we want to go for. But at the same time, we want to control the early morning and the late afternoon glare that comes depending on, you know, if your windows are east-west facing. So we can also control that with artificial light, you know, dimmable lights. Sometimes people put in quite different systems that can create different hues of light, so it's following, so it meets the circadian rhythm, which is our natural rhythm across the event of the day, because some people find it very difficult to go outside. So therefore, you're still having that natural effect with lighting. I guess the other one is the visual stimulation, looking at how cluttered the home is, how do we get storage behind cupboard doors or things like that, so that we minimise that visual stimulation. Some people thrive on that. So that's where it comes into the very specifics of the individual.
Yeah. What about things like colour?
Colour's a really big one. So there has been a small amount of research undertaken on how people with autism react to colour or see colour. Now, that piece of research showed that they see colour brighter than those of us who associate with being neurotypical. So with colour, what I generally advocate for is softer, muter colours as the base. Now, if you've got someone who is sensory seeking and wants really sparkly paint or bright paint, then that could be appropriate in their own private space. But I would always advocate for a low sensory arousal background and then bring any colour in with things that you can change easily, like furnishings and, you know, cushions and curtains and things like that. Certainly also pattern comes into that as well, and colour within pattern, frequency of pattern. So certain carpets, even timber panelling, like the repetitions of the pattern, can visually cause sensory issues as well. So a lot of these things don't cost any more. It's just about making, it's a choice.
One of the places Shelley studied as part of her Churchill Fellowship was a group home in Denmark. It was there she saw the importance of adaptability in the built environment and the profound impact architecture can have on a person's life.
It's called Seniors House because it was for a group of seniors who had been, there was about half a dozen of them from memory, they had been living together for decades. Their parents probably built the first group home for their children in Denmark. And so they've lived together a long time. They built a new building, so there was a lot of new theories and thoughts and research that went into the new home for them. And they had lots of different features. One of them was the adaptability. So within their own units, their robes were on wheels. So they could create a private bedroom area or they could open it up to a space like a studio apartment.
So talk to me about participating on the edge, which I hadn't read about before, and why that's so important for families.
Quite often autistic people find it, because of the sensory or the communication styles, they can find it very challenging to interact in a social situation. And that's where designing for the mind comes into it. We can design a room or a building in a way that can provide that person with that emotional security. Instead of, you know what it's like when you don't know anyone and you're going somewhere and you're walking into a room full of strangers. Most of us could put a smile on our face and bluff our way through it until we find someone we can talk to, right? It's very difficult for autistic people to do that. So providing things, like, for example, the house again in Denmark, it was so brilliant. The apartments had little horizontal viewing windows so that the residents could look out into the common areas or pull their blind down when they wanted that privacy. That gave them that ability to be in their apartment but feel together with people in the common areas. They also had a little bench seat outside their front door of their apartment, okay, so in the passage areas. And so that, again, gave them that next step to being part of something, but on the edge. There was a central lounge room. Their apartments were grouped around that. And then there was viewing windows in some of the lounge room walls. So again, they could see through to that lounge room. Then it goes to predictability. So they can see what's going on. They can see what's happening in that social setting. They can choose to stay where they are and participate, like say at the edge, or they can go in and be part of it. And it gives people that emotional security to decide what is safe for them at any time to be able to be part of that social scene. And that is also one of the residents there is also the absolute perfect example of this, where in their old home, this gentleman could only manage to come out of his own apartment once a day. They said up to 2 minutes a day. That was all he could cope with. In the new home that they were in, with all these things put into place, all these strategies, he was actually coming out to socialise with people he'd been living with for decades, remember? He came out to socialise. They were saying he was coming out a couple of times a day for up to 20 minutes at a time. It is so powerful, because the only thing that had changed was the architecture, not his fellow residents, not the care staff. It was the architecture. So it is such a powerful example of how you can encourage someone and let them be safe in their own interaction just for them. That's their chair to sit, you know, just beyond the living room or within the living room.
Over recent years, there's been a growing awareness of neurodiversity and of children being diagnosed with autism. But what happens when those kids grow up? Do we have housing that meets their specific needs?
No, I don't think so. There's lots of different housing models, whether that be a singular house or, you know, several residents. We've got housing stock, but we don't have a support model. So architecture is like, I always put it like a spoke in the wheel. And it depends on your management model and your support models, depending on the cohort that you're designing for. Some people need more support. So to get a housing model for young adults that would have sensory needs at different levels of other needs required as well, supporting them going into adulthood, the built environment, their home, is really critical to that, because if their mind is not clear from sensory overload or whatever, then it's very hard for them to concentrate on becoming an adult and say, finding a job or you're doing the shopping or whatever. And there are different models around the world that I've seen that are just amazing, and they are partnered. And again, every setting is different. So, for example, in the US, I visited a place called First Place in Phoenix in Arizona. Their model was multi-story apartments in Midtown. So it's close to the light rail. It was close to other transport and employment, because a lot of people with autism do not drive. They also partnered with a community college there to teach these life skills, money management and things like that. Those apartments provided communal areas. It provided the safe spaces. It provided, through the way they treated that building, was the wayfinding, you know, so they understood if you're on the second floor or the third floor or which way to go next. So I think that's what we need more of, is more supported living, no matter what that actual house, where the location is or what that actual house is like. We need a mix of a management model and a housing model to cater for these young adults moving into their adult life.
It doesn't surprise me that we're not ready for our young autistic people to move into independent housing, but that's probably a whole other episode. What is encouraging, though, is that there are real opportunities to make our built environment work better. Things like sensory maps, clear signage showing where to stand or how to move through a space, more muted lighting, softer furnishings that reduce harsh acoustics. Small changes that can have a profound effect on how neurodiverse people experience space. And I would argue, make them better for everyone. It's why Tom is so excited about a new working group he's part of, developing guidelines for Standards Australia to make buildings more accessible and inclusive.
We have a range of people from autistic people, lived experience from our organisation. We have an architect, we have a builder, we have a designer, we have a standards expert, And we're drawing off that cumulative expertise to come up with a framework. And it's a limited framework. It's not going to be a 50-page book. We're hoping for 15 pages, something like that, something small enough to make a difference. But we want to get it out fairly quickly. We hope that it will be published probably late June.
When that lands, what would be one of the first things, one of the first changes we might expect to see in the built environment around us?
I hope really that it's two things I'd like. One is the sensory side of things, that I want to see places that are just more friendly to go in.
Yeah.
I think that's really nice. Also, I think there's a process issue of partnership, that if you are going to build environments, include people with a disability in the building of those environments, right from conception through to execution. That's how you get it right, is to include people with that lived experience. And if people take on that process, then I think we'll end up with a really, really good result. There's, I think, one point I really want to add into this as well, because I think I don't want the world to think that the sensory stuff is either all doom and gloom and it's all overwhelming. One thing about autism and autistic people is the sensory world brings incredible joy. And you'll see it all the time if you know autistic people. Often there's a flap or something when people get really excited when they see something or feel something. And I really want to encourage designers and architects also to think about joy and play and the positive senses and things like that. Because that also, as an element, remediates the stress of the challenge that's out there. And I think it's also a great thing for designers.
I love that.
And architects, is what we're not saying to you is just strip out everything from a building. We don't want clinical white places. You can be creative and you can use design. You can use pops of color. You can use material if you use it carefully and sparingly. But you can use all of your creative juices to create these environments. They're going to look and feel really, really great.
The UK guidelines are now out and they're the first in the world. So if our current discussions around standards actually do come out in June, will that make us the second in the world to go in this direction?
As far as I'm aware, yes. And I think it then becomes a fairly momentous thing for this country to have something relatively early in the scheme of built environment.
Where would this put us in the sense of, I guess, advocating in a larger sense about these issues?
I think it gives us a really strong leadership position in the world. I think it potentially is transformational in how Australia will be built in the future. I'm really excited about the potential for this. If we can weave this in from this year in how we build new things, how people will experience in Australia next year will start to be different and feel different. And that's a thrilling thing to think about.
Dr. Tom Tutton, Head of Aspect Autism Friendly. When I asked Tom Tutton to explain neurodiversity to me, he said the term blossomed from the word biodiversity and the idea that in an ecosystem, that system is only enhanced by the diversity of plants. When he thinks about neurodiversity in architecture, he sees the same result, only this time it's about creating spaces that work for a diversity of brains. And when you break it down to its parts, more predictability, more choice in lighting and textures, better acoustics, it's easy to see that making spaces more accessible for neurodiverse people is going to make spaces better for everyone. I'm excited to see what the guidelines provide in the middle of the year. What do you think of making our buildings more welcome for the many of us who experience them differently? If you've got thoughts, I'd love to hear from you. Email me at bydesign@abc.net.au. And a lot of you do get in touch. I received a lovely email from listener Alison telling us all about her favourite adaptive reuse in Beechworth, Victoria, the Mayday Escape Rooms based in an old 19th century asylum. She says it adds so much depth and reality to an already highly enjoyable experience. The structure naturally adds the old building charms, including creaky floorboards, old building smells, and the view out the window is a continuation of the theme of the room. It's just utterly delightful, and my description doesn't do it justice. She recommends Beechworth as worth the visit. Thanks, Ali. I'll keep that in mind next time I'm nearby. You've been listening to By Design. Follow the podcast to catch future episodes and listen out for our bonus series, Extraordinary Every Day, released every Thursday. Next time on By Design, how do you design your way out of a sinking city?
those who live near the coastal area, they are the one that really struggle to have the water for their daily life. And because of the climate change, the rise of the sea level, yeah, nowadays the high tide is higher than before. And that's also impact to their daily activities. On them, for example, for the kids go to school, to go for work, for example, they really have to find a way to handle this kind of situation.
Join me for that next time on By Design, because in a rapidly changing world, design matters. The producer of By Design is Siobhan Hunt, the sound engineer is Ross Richardson, and the executive producer is Rhiannon Brown. This program was produced on Gadigal land and the lands of the Wurundjeri.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.